Well, hi, folks. This is Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is Thursday, January the 8th, 2026. Crazy, isn't it? 26. And this is episode 3784 of the Survival Podcast. I want to do something I don't really do on the air much. I really never have. I want to gloat a little bit. Just a little bit. Just a little bit. And here's what I want to gloat about. When I started this show all the way back in 2008, it took me about 3 to 4 months to get some traction. And once I did and people started to actually like share my show, listen to my show, I started to actually build a model that I didn't start taking money out of yet, but I knew I could build a monetization plan. And I actually started gearing myself toward taking this podcast full time, which is a big deal today. To start a podcast today and go full time is a big deal. It's not easy. It's one of those things that's simple, but it's not easy. It takes a lot of work, a lot of dedication. You have to get good at your craft. You have to put a good business model behind it, good monetization model behind it. And you have to, you know, be able to come up with things to talk about on a daily basis. People will listen. Well, once you start that process and you start getting on the way, you attract something called haters. And I don't want to, like, bring up any individual ones of them and all. All I'm going to say is that over the year, I have had literally thousands upon thousands of hate mails. I've had people attack me online. I've had people say he doesn't know what he's doing. Yeah, I've had people talk all kinds of shit about me. And I really didn't plan on saying this at all today. Just when I said 26, it hit me. It's 2026. I started the show in 2008. I've done almost 4,000 episodes. We'll hit 4,000 episodes some point this year, probably later in the year. All those people, I don't even know their names. I don't know who they are. We had one recently. We had one on Tuesday that popped in and got all upset because I don't vote or whatever, you know, and run his mouth. Do you think any of these people, you know, if we go back to the beginning, we go back to those first couple of years, ever thought that Jack Spirko and the Survival Podcast community would still be kicking ass almost 18 years later? You know, it's a chapter of my new book. If you don't have haters in the world today, especially if you're visible in what you're doing, then what you're doing has no impact. So, just a little bit of a gloat there. I'm still here. All of the attacks, all the slings, all the arrows, I'm still here. I'm glad to still be here, and I'm glad to be with you guys. And if you're new to the show, then this is the first time you've ever listened, and you're thinking, who is this jerk? First of all, jerk is what I am called by the people that love me the most in this audience, which is a joke that we won't get into today. And we even have, if you go to the website, thesurvivalpodcast.com, and put in jerk, you'll probably find an episode that runs about 5 hours with people calling in, each getting 90 seconds to tell me why I'm a jerk in their life. It was one of the greatest moments of my life putting that show together. Okay, so that's who this jerk is. He's a jerk, just encouraging real knowledge. But the other thing is, stick around. I'm going to tell you what we're about to talk about today with our expert panel, and it'll be a good show. And this is the only time in almost 18 years that I've ever started a show this way. Anyway, so what are we talking about today? Again, Thursday, time for the expert panel Q&A show for the week. And I've got a good lineup for you. Some of the stuff's from even a few weeks ago, as we got a glut of content right at the end. And I've got some brand new content, some people we ain't heard from in a while. And I still have a lot in the bank. So if you're an expert panel member, then you don't hear a segment that you sent me today, you didn't do anything wrong. And if you get an email later today or tomorrow, and you probably will, and it says, I need more content, that's still true, because I have enough content almost to do a show next week, and we know how things go. And I also have some people that I have no content from, and I like to keep everybody on the air because it keeps the audience wanting more from you. Well, who do we got this week? Well, of course, we have something from the Ron Paul Liberty Report, and we hear from those guys every week like clockwork. But it's not Chris and or Ron Paul this time. It's Dan McAdams. I haven't heard from Dan in a long time, but he has a segment for us today about Cartel de los Sloths. De Los Souls. Well, what's the problem with that? What are we talking about before? So that was the organization Nicolas Maduro was supposedly heading as a cartel. It turns out there is no such actual group. I'm going to hear what Dan has to say, and I'm going to tell you why I don't really care. But this is sloppy police work. This is sloppy work by the Department of Justice. This is sloppy work, period. And it could come back to cause some real problems, okay? Joel Riles will talk about stopping a dog from pulling on a leash. I have an add-on in this one that's totally unrelated to everything Joel says that may be helpful to more than just the person asking the question. Andy McCann will say it's 2026. And that means a lot of you guys have goals for 2026, like lose some weight. He wants you to know something. Your tongue is an asshole. Not literally, figuratively. It will make you do bad things. It will make you crave things that you don't really need. I'll have a little add-on in that one. Matt Sursley will talk about how to use the bonus depreciation that we were given in the Big Beautiful Bill on your taxes, but some of the things that it won't do for you as well. And Jesse Markowitz will talk about something called liquid Bitcoin. If you've never heard of it before, you will today. You'll find out why you should care and how it's used. It's basically a Bitcoin derivative. It's similar in a way, sort of kind of like Lightning, but for totally different purposes. Nicholas Ferguson will talk about how you can root a plant called, I'm going to try to say this, Arbor Vitae. I think that's how he says it. We'll see when he says it if I'm right. But this guy wants to do something that just probably isn't going to work, but Nick will give you what will work and maybe a way to go a little bit further than what will work. And then I will talk to you about something I'm kind of excited about. I'm not like, woohoo, the world is saved or anything, but I am kind of excited about it. The new food pyramid. RFK just turned it upside down and tweaked it a little bit. But I'm going to tell you what it really says. Because I don't think people know what it really says yet. And it is a marked improvement over the bullshit that they taught us in school that we have been listening to and hearing from our government for over 50 years. The original food pyramid was a bullshit machine designed to get you to eat the same ratios that a fucking calf eats when it's being force-fed to grow up into a giant cow so we can slaughter it. It's a pig feed bag. Okay, the macros of the dietary formula known as the food pyramid up till now match perfectly a bag of pig feed. Humans should not be eating something that's designed to make pigs really fat and ready to harvest in 8 months. But that's what we've been eating. So I'm going to tell you that it's good. Maybe it's not as good as you think, but it's actually really strict in some ways, except that it's not. I'll explain it all when we get to that. With that, let's go ahead and hear from Dan McAdams over at the Ron Paul Liberty Report about something called Cartel de los Souls, which apparently doesn't actually exist. Is this going to be a problem?
Now, we remember that there was a $50 million bounty put on President Nicolas Maduro's head, the president of Venezuela, and that $50 million bounty argued that he was the head of a narco-terrorist drug cartel called Cartel del Solas. And you can actually see it now. Secretary Marco Rubio, just in November, he said the State Department intends to designate Cartel de los Soles as a foreign terrorist organization headed by the illegitimate Nicolas Maduro. The group has corrupted the institutions of government in Venezuela and is responsible for terrorist violence conducted by and with other designated foreign terrorist organizations, as well as for trafficking drugs into the U.S. and Europe. They spent weeks and weeks on this narrative, Dr. Paul. There are foreign narco-terrorist cartels running the country. We've got to do something. And Americans started buying it. They started believing it. Well, maybe there's something to this. Maybe it's okay to blow up boats. They're all terrorists. Well, this dropped yesterday. Put on this next clip. Now that they have Maduro in their grasp, the Justice Department, you wouldn't believe it, the Justice Department drops the claim that Venezuela's Cartel de los Soles is an actual group. So they're saying, after hyping this for months, getting Americans hyped up on invading Venezuela, now they're saying, just kidding, guys, there's no such thing. This reminds me, Dr. Paul, of the WMDs for Iraq. They swore up and down for years. They're working on WMDs. They're working on WMDs. And then when the invasion happened, they got their invasion. Remember President George W. Bush? He was joking about it at a White House correspondents' dinner. He was looking under the couch and looking under the coffee table laughing. Where's those WMDs? They just don't care. This is exactly it. The Cartel de los Soles is the WMDs of this operation, and it's already completely falling apart.
I love Dan, but I'm going to say that Dan tends to do a little bit of selective editing in these situations when they match his point. And I don't mean that an insult. I guess we all do it at times. But here's what I mean. Like, I heard that claim, and when it was made, I went out and investigated it, and overall, it's true. It's completely true. But I wasn't that motivated by it, to be honest. But then, you know, when it comes in from one of your members, then you take the time to go learn a little bit more. So it turns out the only major publication in America that actually covered this is the New York Times, and the story hadn't been out long enough yet for it to get into archive.org or anything where I can get to it without a paywall. So I was unable to read the New York Times take on it. Most of the other places are complete rags that are carrying this story. New York Times is not. I'm not saying that at all. But, like, if I'm going to read something from Salon, I'm going to get leftist drivel, and I know it. I'm not even going to get an attempt to appear even-handed. So I was able to find it on some of the UK websites, and I don't remember. I'll look real quick here because I did put the link in for you. Daily Mail, which is still kind of a rag, but at least it has more credibility than Salon, and they usually, even if they angle the story, they'll give you all the information. So, did the United States government just decide to make up the name Cartel de los Soles? Is that what happened? No. Okay. So, don't you think maybe an honest journalism question here is, where did the name come from? Where did the name come from? Did they have a brainstorming session? What do we call it? Like wag the dog or something? Old shoe and going to war with Canada and all that shit? Like, was that what was done here? No. Where did they get the name? Does anybody listening to this that's taken a position already on either side of it, see, I told you, it doesn't matter, whatever. Have any of y'all bothered to take the 5 minutes it took me to find out where the name came from? The name came from Venezuelan and other Central and South American journalists who named the organization that they were trying to show existed that name, which they did say Maduro was the head of. Got that? So what those journalists were saying, this is not our Justice Department, this is not Nicolas Maduro, this is not Donald Trump or Marco Rubio. By the way, I despise Rubio as a slimy, scummy scumbag, just in case anybody has the wrong idea here, but I try to call balls and strikes. The journalist trying to say, hey, look what's going on here, they named it that. So when they say it's not real, it means that the people running it didn't call it that. Now, why is it, if does that mean anything then? It does. See, the thing about courts, judges, and lawyers, and properly instructed juries, is that the law is not really that subject to interpretation, and things like how you obtain a warrant for arrest, or a warrant for search and seizure, right? Or how you obtain a in absentia indictment, which means we've indicted a person and charged them with a crime. We've gone to the grand jury process, and we've gotten an indictment, not just we've detained you, we put you in front of a grand jury, and then, you know, then do you actually face charges? See, in all those things, they're kind of sticklers for details. And when your main method of acquiring a warrant or an indictment turns out to be fraudulent, even if not by intent, it calls a lot of things into question here. And if you do happen to have a federal judge who leans a little bit, well, Marxist, and they're looking for a reason to throw the whole fucking thing out, it's a pretty good one. Am I saying that's going to happen? I don't know. I don't think so. There's a lot of tricks that a prosecutor can pull at that level. Change of venue, change of judiciary, etc. It is difficult when you are the defense and the federal government's coming at you to get some of these things done. If you're the federal government, the burden to get it done is a lot lower. So you might find a way to get it in front of a friendlier judge, at least as it advances. But it's a big mistake. And it makes it look like you got, to quote Barack Obama, the JV team running things in the Trump administration to fuck something up like that. It's like they just decided to, like, oh, that's what it's called, that's what we'll call it in the warrant. You know, you might want to get some actual information on something you're naming specifically in legal paperwork. So, do I think Nicolas Maduro was enabling drug trade throughout Central, South America, and into the United States? Absolutely. Does the fact that they were using a name that was assigned to the entity by journalists in South America really matter in the macro? In principle, no, but in practice, it might. This might be one of the biggest fuck-ups of all time, legally. And it might not. We'll have to wait and see. With that, let's leave the world of politics behind for the rest of the day. I guess my segment kind of comes in, but it's really about diet. And let's move on to things that are more practical in the world of people that are preparedness-minded, lifestyle design-minded, homesteaders, etc. And, of course, dogs are a big part of the life of many Americans, millions and millions and millions, but especially homesteaders and freedom seekers like to have dogs around. What if your dog doesn't listen? What if you're trying to train your dog and he's dragging you around on a leash? Joel Riles of Canine Academy and Fortress Canine is going to talk to us about that right now.
Hello everyone, this is Joel with Fortress Canine coming back at you for another expert counsel segment. And today's question, it's related to the one we did last week about taking your dog out to go to the bathroom. But he mentioned in his question that his dog basically drags him out the door every time he takes him out to use the bathroom, right? So anytime he's trying to take his dog out on a leash, he's basically getting dragged around. And he specifically mentions he's tried different collars, but not the prong collar. Here's the bottom line. If your dog is pulling on a lead, okay, the easiest way to fix that is to give them corrections when they do that. And the easiest and simplest way to give your dog corrections for doing that is the prong collar. Real quick, a lot of people don't like the prong collar because it kind of looks like a spike collar, right? Certain people will actually call it a spike collar. And what that infers is there's like sharpened spikes that are digging into the dog's neck when they pull on it. That's not what a prong collar is at all. If you get the prong collars, we sell and recommend the Herm Springer prong collar made in Europe and Germany and Austria. They are actually rounded on the ends to be more comfortable for the dog's neck. What the prong collar actually does is when you pop it, so you have a loose lead and you pop the loose lead, it pinches their neck. And this mimics what a mother would do with her puppies. When a puppy does something it's not supposed to, she's nursing and it bites her nipple or something like that, she nips them on the neck, they squeal, ah, that hurt. And then they learn, don't do that anymore. It's something the dog naturally understands. The one thing you will realize if you start using a prong collar, if you let them pull on a prong collar, they will start pulling more and more on the prong collar. So what that tells you is the prongs alone don't create a tremendous amount of discomfort even when the dog pulls, right? It's the pop on the prong collar that actually gives the correction. So if we have a dog that's pulling, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get a prong collar and we're going to properly fit it to the dog. I go into a lot of detail in this on Canine Academy, but basically you want the prong collar to, if you grab a hold of it on the dog's neck, you can spin it back and forth on their neck, and it's not like taking the skin of their neck and twisting it around, right? It's freely spinning on their neck. If the dog has really thick fur, this might be a little more difficult, and that's okay. And then I don't want it to pull off their head. So then I take it and I kind of pull it like I'm going to slip it off their head. If it slips right off, it's too big, right? I need to shorten it up a little bit. You shorten the prong collar by popping links out. Again, that's easy to find information on if you want to figure out how to do all that. I properly fit the prong collar to the dog. I put it on the dog. I clip my lead in, and I tell the dog to walk with me, whatever your command is for that. We use Foose. So I tell the dog, Foose, that means walk with me. Now, if you're just starting this, The first time it happens, your dog's going to lunge out and lunge to the end of the lead. When they lunge to the end of the lead, I'm going to anticipate that because that's the behavior this dog has already established. And I'm not going to pop with my arm. I'm not going to pull back, but I am going to like lock in. I'm going to flex my arm so that there's not much movement when the dog hits the end of the lead, right? It's almost like I'm the fence post that the dog is tethered to, and I don't want to give. I don't want to let the dog pull me and let my arm out slowly and relax that pop that it's naturally giving itself. I want it to experience that pop. And as soon as they lunge out and they pop themselves, I just repeat my command, foos up, and I'll kind of guide them back in with the lead. Again, I go into a lot more detail on this along with the video demonstrations and everything else on Canine Academy, but I need the dog when they lunge to the end of the lead to experience that pop. Now, once they start to kind of get it, what you'll find is they'll experiment with where the edges are of where they can be, right? And you may want a really strict foos where they walk right at your side, their shoulders are at your hips. I can turn left and right and the dog never gets in my way. Or you may just want to walk with your dog where they're kind of out in front of you, sniffing the ground a little bit, but not pulling you down the road and not getting in your way, right? Whatever level of performance you're looking at for your dog, you need to establish those. And the way that we do that is as the dog moves, and they get about 6 inches from where I want their maximum distance to be, I'm going to bump back with my arm, right? And I'm going to do that in a way I shouldn't. My lead should be set at the length that it naturally is going to do that for me. But right before my lead gets tight, I just bump a little bit with my arm. It's like a 6 or 8 inch movement that I bump back with my arm. And they realize, oh, that's an edge. And they'll go forward and they'll find out where the edge is forward. They'll go out to the side and they'll find out where the edge is to the side. And with a puppy, I generally just want them to walk at my side and not get in front of me and trip me up, right? So I'm a little bit more lenient with a puppy. And then as they get older and they have a little better understanding, I bring them more and more into my side. And then we start doing turns and other drills that bring that into a more strict discipline, walk at your side. But the bottom line is, don't let the dog pull on the prong. Now, usually what happens is you put the prong on, they start to pull, they feel the tension of the prong, and they go, ooh, that's a little uncomfortable, and then they barely pull. But what will happen is if you just leave it at that, is they'll start figuring out, I can pull a little harder, I can pull a little harder, and then you're right back to where you started pretty much. So you need to be using those pops on the prong so that the dog realizes, okay, got it, that's not what I'm supposed to do. Now, some really stubborn dogs will hit the end of that lead 6-8 times, right? I try not to do this if I don't have to, but if the dog is really stubborn and they're just bam, 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 and at the end of the lead over and over again, I'll actually do a bam, bam correction, a pop, pop correction. And then it's usually some kind of a fairly harsh verbal like, hey, fooey that, knock it off, right? It's like, calm down, stop trying to pull me, and then as soon as they're not pulling me anymore, good job, good easy. Good foos, whatever it is. And notice the tone of my voice is very different there. Knock that off, fooey it, is harsh in my tone. And then I go, good job, good easy, good foos. I'm letting them know, I'm not mad with you anymore. You're doing great now, right? If your tone doesn't change, the dog will be like, I still don't know if I'm doing what you want or not, right? If you're still like, yeah, good job, I'm so frustrated with you, that doesn't help, right? You've got to actually bring your tone down so that the dog is like, oh, now my person's happy with me. I guess I shouldn't do that other behavior as much anymore. And if you're consistent with that, they'll stop doing that behavior pretty much at all. And so, again, now that you've got that taken care of, if it's in the context of going outside, using the bathroom, etc., I highly recommend setting up and using the boundaries and the entranceways and all that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Bring the dog up to a door, put them in a sit, open the door, good sit. If they break sit, close the door, correct them, put them back in their sit, open the door, good sit. Now let's go through the door, good foos, sit again, I'm going to close the door. And you can set this up. It literally is going to take you an extra 2 to 3 minutes a day to run these drills, and pretty soon you won't have to run them at all, and your frustration with your dog will dissolve and go away. So I hope that's been really helpful for you. We go into a lot more detail on how to use the prong, how to get your dog to foos, how to get your dog to seats, all of those things, along with very detailed video demonstrations. And I'm talking to you as I'm working the dogs. on Canine Academy. So go check that out. If you're trying to work with your dog and get better obedience, go to thesurvivalpodcast.com, click on the Canine Academy banner, and check out all of our options over there. If you're looking for a working line puppy or a fully trained protection dog, check out fortresscanine.com. And keep in mind, this is running out pretty soon. By December 20th, if you're looking for a puppy, a working line puppy, a German Shepherd, Belgian Malinois, or Dutch Shepherd, we're offering $500 off and an advanced course at Canine Academy. If you purchase a dog before then, it can be on a puppy we have on ground right now, or it could be on one of our three litters coming up. So if you're interested in that, that's something that you're thinking about doing, make sure you contact me. You can either click the consultation form at fortresscanine.com, or you can text me at 813-836-9244, and we'll get you taken care of. Remember, until next time, train hard and stay safe.
Completely agree. Still have an addition. An unrelated addition, though. We had a dog that was bad about this, and this dog had a tolerance for discomfort that was impressive. I mean, I could pop him hard, and it would work until I handed the leash to anybody else in the family, and this dog would drag you. I could put this dog in a normal collar, not a prong collar, and he would heal for me, but he wouldn't do it for anybody else. He didn't go crazy with it. He was just like a bull pulling a cart or something. He just was, a big barrel-chested lab chow mix that my son named Blackie. And he was a wonderful dog. I mean, he was not a bad dog. He was not a poorly behaved dog overall, and we didn't walk a lot on a leash, and that probably made it harder. But I was listening to some different videos by different dog people, because I believe it's good to get a good broad spectrum, and it was long before I knew Joel. This was before I was even doing the show. This is how long ago this was. And I'm looking for a way to deal with this dog, because popping him with a prong collar is not getting it done. Because he doesn't actually have the problem unless it's someone he doesn't respect fully. And getting them to do it, you know, it would work until it didn't, I guess is the way to put it. And he would just drag, didn't care. Well, I listened to this one guy, and he said there are certain dogs that are working breeds, and they need to feel like they're accomplishing something. And so one of the things he suggested for a dog like this was to go ahead and put the dog under some sort of a burden, and that would give the dog the feeling that it was accomplishing something, and it would change the behavior. So what he meant was, like, get the dog a vest, but like a cargo vest, and put some weight on the dog. Not enough to hurt him, but just enough to feel like, hey, something's here. And I also believe this helps the same way that like a thunder shirt helps, where if you're compressing the dog's side a little bit, they're more relaxed. So I got him a vest, and I put a, like I'm saying, not a ton of weight, but enough weight to feel it. I put a couple, put a box of 7mm Remington Magnum, right, there's two pockets, one on each side. So I put one box of shells on each side for him to give him some weight. Probably could have filled him with sand or something too. It just was what laying around. We put it on the dog, and the dog became perfect on a leash. And the only thing we ever had to do after that was give the dog a little bit of weight. That's maybe unconventional. It may not work everywhere, but since it's real world, I wanted y'all to know about it. Next up, let's hear from Annie McCann about how your tongue can not literally but figuratively be an asshole when it comes to you setting goals for 2026 or for any time at all, period, when it comes to diet.
Hello and good morning, guys. This is Andy McCann coming to you from Woodstock, Georgia, where I own CrossFit Garage, and I focus a lot on health and fitness. So my job is to help you look good naked and become harder to kill. And I just found that doing something like CrossFit is the biggest hack in the history of hacks when it comes to your health and fitness. Now, as you guys know, if you've been listening, I have five pillars that I really push into. It's how you eat, sleep, move, think, and connect. But most of you, it's how you eat. You got to start somewhere. So I told Jack I'd give him some things to start or begin the new year with or coming into the new year, and most of you are going to try to do something with your diet, and I'm going to tell you how to fix that and why it fails, and hopefully give you a nice little start. I also will produce this same sort of content over at my podcast, Fitness, Food, and Finance, and it's because, you know, we're trying to lay a firm foundation in those three things. But here's what I want to tell you. almost everybody says, hey, my New Year's goal is to lose some weight. Hey, that is great, but you need to figure out, like, what a realistic goal is. So 50 pounds is only realistic if you weigh, like, 500 pounds. If you weigh, I don't know, if you're a 6-foot man weighing 200 pounds and you say you want to lose 50 pounds, I'm going to say that's probably too much. You probably can't lose that 50 pounds. I mean, proportionally, that's just a lot of weight. So first, make a good goal. And I really say that the goal should be, I just want to start eating smarter and better and do dot, dot, dot. So most of the reason that diets fail is because your tongue is an asshole and it wants you to eat certain things and you just simply can't stop the craving. So the craves are going to get us. And I mean, much like the rhythm. So you really need to focus on who you're becoming and not what you're missing. So it's not necessarily the food, the diet, the plan, or whatever. It's that your tongue's going to crave it. And you need to reframe what you're doing and it's not I'm just giving up food to lose some weight. It's I'm changing my lifestyle. So future casting who you'll become is much more effective. Okay, so the diet's going to fail because of you. The next thing I'm going to tell you is this. Many of you are going to say, in addition to that diet, I'm going to start working out. And so I actually had some texts back and forth with Nicole, and she said, hey, my knee is swelling up. What's going on? So we talked about it a little bit, and here's something for you all to know. When you go back to doing stuff, your body's not used to it. So don't jump in like a hero. Go super slow. You've got 365 days to work with. There's no such thing as a fitness emergency. You could say fitness emergency as in like fitting this pizza in my mouth, but as with your health and fitness, there's not an emergency. You're not going to fix it in one day, so you can't go in and be like, I just deadlifted 500 pounds. I'm healthy again. That's not how it works. It's stacking day after day. So just like your tongue wants to ruin your diet, your consistency to the plan and your imagination of who you were ruins the plan as well. So let that go. Just go in nice and easy. I would even say if you go to a gym that has a workout like some sort of CrossFit gym or gym like that, it's a small gym that has a program up for you, you look at it and you're like, hey, there's, you know, advanced, intermediate, and beginner. I'm going to do the beginner. And then I would half whatever the beginner is, right? So maybe not the time domain. Let's say, I don't know, it's telling you to work out for 10 minutes. Yeah, fine, do 10 minutes or 20 minutes. Sure, do it, whatever. But don't go with intensity. Don't go hard. Just work on the movements. Just be there and be sweaty. Build the routine. Let your body feel, oh, this is what you want. Don't shock it into movement. So don't do that. All right. Hey, guys, I'm here for you. Should you need me, you can email me, andy@crossfitgarage.com, or you can text me. My cell phone number is all over the website, or email Jack and say, hey, question for Andy. I'm happy to answer it. I really want you guys to do well and live well, live long and prosper, right? I want you to have the best that you can have in 2026 and beyond. And unfortunately, it does start with curbing your tongue's desires for what it wants and showing up for yourself, that consistency. All right, guys, I got answers. If you got questions, send them on in. Y'all take care.
So we have a question from Sean Mills, longtime community member, served on the expert council for a very long time until he had to step back for some professional responsibilities, presented at a lot of workshops, really good dude, and knows a lot about electrics and photovoltaics and engineering and stuff like that. But you know, like anybody, no matter how much you know, you don't know everything. And he has a tax question for Matt Sersley, our agorist tax attorney who serves on our expert council, about accelerated depreciation. And as you'll hear, Sean's idea won't work in this situation. However, the concept of accelerated depreciation is something we can use going into the new tax year, and Matt will talk about why it doesn't work for what Sean wants it to do, but areas where it does work and how that might affect some of your tax planning and purchases going forward.
Hey, TSP, this is Matthew Sersley with Agorist Tax Advice. I got a question from the Telegram group to answer today. This is from our very own Sean Mills. With the new bonus depreciation rules, can I buy a vehicle this year in 2025 and 100% depreciate it next year? I actually love this question. It's not a question I'd really thought about before, but you know, what are the rules on buying stuff this year and taking it next year with these new tax changes? But the short answer is no. You cannot buy a vehicle this year and depreciate it 100% next year by the book. Now, the new rules are a renewal of some of the original Trump tax cut rules on what it's called 100% bonus depreciation. And it had been going down. It was going to be 40% instead of 100% this year, but they moved it back up to 100%. And it's going to be 100% for a while. It's available for vehicles, machinery, equipment, and other business-use property. It also partially can apply to real estate purchases, and that's my favorite place to use bonus depreciation, is to get a quick write-off on buying a rental property. One cool thing about bonus depreciation is it applies whether you finance or pay in cash. So, you know, you could potentially buy a $50,000 car for maybe $10,000 down, but you get the $50,000 write-off. Now, I've talked about it before. I'll talk about it again. I do not like buying a car just to buy a car for the tax purposes. But if you need a new car, then buying it in your business, using it in your business, and writing it off is a great way to save money on taxes. As always, use the tax code to save taxes on money you're already going to spend. Don't spend money just because it's going to lower your tax bill, because almost always you end up with less money in your pocket. The problem with this question is bonus depreciation requires two things. You have to purchase and place the item into service in the same year. So if you buy it in 2025, even if you don't use it, like I say you buy it December 31st and it sits in the lot, and then you start using it for your business in 2026, doesn't work. You have to actually buy it and use it in your business in the same year, or you cannot do bonus depreciation under the current rules. So there are reasons to buy those things early. You can still depreciate them in other ways partially. You can maybe use what's called Section 179 depreciation retroactively, but you can't do bonus depreciation. Now, you can't just buy any vehicle and do bonus depreciation. Cars have special rules. Autos have special rules. First of all, you have to use it at least 50% for the business, or you can't depreciate it at all. And if you don't use it 100% for the business, you will actually only get the percentage you use it for the business. So if you buy it and use it 80% for your business, 20% for personal use, you can do 80% of the purchase price as bonus depreciation, but not 100%. You actually do have to buy the vehicle to do bonus depreciation. You can't lease it for this. The real restriction on this is it has to be over 6,000 pounds GVWR. So bigger vehicles, over 3 tons to apply. This is actually why a lot of people switched over to SUVs in the 2000s, because that's when this rule came into effect. And you used to be able to write off, you know, sedans, and then you couldn't anymore because they didn't weigh enough. So it's got to be over 6,000 pounds GVWR. You can check online whether a certain vehicle qualifies for that. But if it's under that weight, there's a special rule called the luxury auto cap, where you can't depreciate more than $20,000 in year one. And then after year one, you have to use standard depreciation. So even with bonus depreciation, you don't get 100%. You get the first $20,000 and then write off the rest. Now, if it's a used vehicle, you can still write off 100% if the purchase price is less than $20,000. For all of this stuff, documentation is going to matter. They're going to want mileage logs, especially if it's not 100% business use. They will want to see a business use case for it, and you really should keep track of the date of first use. So if you want to buy, if you want 100% bonus depreciation in 2025, you got to put it, buy it and put it into place this year. If you're targeting a deduction for 2026, you cannot buy it in 2025. Now, there are some car dealerships that will work with you on this. There are some that will not. Again, they want to sell this year to get their bonus or whatever. But there are some that is like, you can sign the deal, you can ink the contract now, and then it goes into effect January 1st or January 2nd, 2026. And then you will be able to buy it and put it into service in that same year. But maybe if there's like a Christmas sale or something, get advantage to that. You know, this is a complicated topic. Auto stuff is complicated in general. If you have a business vehicle, you need to bone up on this, unless you're just doing mileage, which is what most people do. And frankly, most people do mileage because it saves them more money and it's way simpler. But bonus depreciation is an incredibly strong tax tool for business owners. And the fact that it's now back at 100% is amazing for saving money on taxes, but you need to use it correctly. Bonus depreciation has very specific rules, and if you don't use it correctly, you could think you're getting a big deduction and not get it. So if you're considering a particularly big purchase, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or more, you really want to make sure you get the timing of that correctly. If you want to consult with me about saving money on your taxes, whether you're a high-earning W-2 employee or a business owner, please reach out to me at agoristaxadvice.com/TSP, where you'll get my full Agorist Tax Toolkit. It's a number of useful tools, documents, and spreadsheets to help you save money, whether you're a business owner or a private person. You'll also get a link to schedule a call with me and see if I can help you long-term. Have a great day.
So my only addition on this to Matthew's excellent coverage of it has really nothing to do with depreciation expense, either accelerated or otherwise, and vehicles in particular. Just a general observation about some things. And I don't think Sean was misunderstanding this, but I think a lot of people are, including the news and including a lot of pundits that are using this one way or the other to convey something that just isn't true, and that is that we can expect that all of this tax policy will be seen by people in their tax returns that they're going to receive in the next few months in 2026. No. Nothing in the big, beautiful bill that I'm aware of anyway does jack diddly crap about the taxes you paid in 2025, because that's when the bill was passed, and all these provisions took force on January 1 of this year, which is something that Matt was kind of making some points about there. And I want to give you one example, and maybe I should have Matt on, and we should do kind of a rehash of all the good and the bad and the neutral in this bill, but also some of the misunderstanding. So in this bill, there's no tax on overtime. How many times have you heard Orange Man say that? No tax on overtime, no tax on tips, no tax on blah, 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 blah. Okay, fine, hold on. What does that mean? Let's say that this week, we won't worry about hourly rates or anything like that. You can calculate if you want to. But let's just say this week you get some overtime. Yoo-hoo. Woo, I got some overtime. I'm not going to pay tax on it. And when you look at your paycheck, you say your regular income was, I don't know, $600. And you made $200 in overtime. So the $600, you already know what that means. Now you're going to pay tax on it at whatever your tax rate is. But the $200 of overtime, you would think, well, I'm going to pay tax on the $600. I'm not going to pay tax on the $200. Well, I mean, there are different contracts. I've seen people, they make double time on overtime or whatever. But, the standard in our country is 1.5 times. So if you make $10 an hour, then you make $15. If you make $20, then you make $30, right? Everybody understands how this works. Well, it doesn't matter how much you're making an hour. You say you made $200 even in overtime, to give it an even number. That means that your regular pay for that was about $133 and change. It's about a third. And that means that the part that was the kicker, that was the time, the half in the time and a half, was about $66.67. Call it $67. So when you made $600 that week, you will then not pay tax on about $70 of it. That's what it really means. And there's a lot of shit that's being overhyped in the big, beautiful bill that's like that. It's real. The claim is true. But the phrasing of the claim is misleading. So maybe we should pick that apart, because taxes are part of life. Money is part of life. And the more money you keep, the more you can do for your own freedom directly, and the less of your money the government has to adversely affect it through indirect corruption of your freedom by them using your own money against you. I mean, if you want, we talk about statist jujitsu all the time, and we do make the state look like a bunch of ass clowns at times because they're not agile, they can't think, we can use their own rules against them. But when it comes to real jujitsu, the absolute master is the state, because the state can take your club and beat you with it at the same time, as in take your money and spend it against you at the same time. Next up, let's hear about something called Liquid Bitcoin from Jesse Markowitz.
Hi, this is Jesse Markowitz with YourPersonalBitcoinAssistant.com. Today I've got a question from Bob. Bob asks, could you please describe Liquid and how it may be beneficial or perhaps a use case for members of our community? Liquid refers to the Liquid Network, a blockchain adjacent to Bitcoin, but not the same as Bitcoin. It's kind of like soy milk. It's good and people like it, but it's not really milk, even though it is used like milk. On the Liquid blockchain, you can create different assets or tokens. These tokens can then be issued and managed just like any other crypto token. The key asset we're interested in today is LBTC, Liquid Bitcoin. People use Liquid Bitcoin because it's faster and cheaper than regular Bitcoin on-chain transactions. The basic idea is that a certain amount of Bitcoin is locked up on the main chain and then used as Liquid Bitcoin on the Liquid network. This way, 1 BTC equals 1 LBTC. The two are pegged together. When you lock Bitcoin so you can get LBTC, it is called pegging in. Pegging out is converting Liquid Bitcoin back to BTC, unlocking it on the main chain. The Liquid network is faster and cheaper than native Bitcoin transactions. It also provides slightly greater privacy, since the amounts and asset types that are being transferred are hidden by default. But the network can still see the addresses and transaction graphs, who's sending stuff to different people. Those are still publicly visible. And the folks that run the Liquid network can see the full data. There are wallets designed specifically to support the Liquid network. Their user interface allows you to easily peg in and peg out, converting your Bitcoin into Liquid Bitcoin and back, and allowing you to use Liquid Bitcoin very similar to how you would use regular Bitcoin. This has worked, and it's why a number of companies and individuals use it today. For large numbers of small value transactions, Liquid can be cheaper than on-chain Bitcoin, and the fees tend to be more predictable. Block times are 1 minute, not 10 minutes, as in Bitcoin, so transactions confirm faster as well. If you've got a group of people transacting in Bitcoin frequently and for smaller amounts, it might make sense to do those transactions in Liquid for the faster confirmations and lower fees. Another use case might be doing dollar cost averaging. If you're making purchases on an hourly basis or whatever it might be, but a lot of transactions, again, taking those large number small transactions on Liquid can be cheaper. Then when you're ready, you can consolidate all of those together into a small number, larger transactions as you peg out and get that back on the Bitcoin network. The trade-off with using Liquid is that it is a custodial solution. While you hold the keys to your LBTC, you no longer have the keys to the Bitcoin backing the LBTC. Once you peg in, you're trusting the Liquid network. Your Bitcoin is no longer your Bitcoin. You've traded it for Liquid Bitcoin. The Liquid network is run by a federation of members, unlike Bitcoin, which is fully decentralized. This is better than most custodial solutions that are just a single company. Because of its distributed, federated nature, no single company controls Liquid. But the federation still has custody of your Bitcoin, not your keys, not your coins. When you're done transacting in Liquid Bitcoin and you want to peg out and get back to real Bitcoin, you need the cooperation of the folks who run the Liquid network. The Canadian privately held company Blockstream funds most of the core Liquid development work. They did the initial development work, and they maintain the reference implementation. The software for Liquid blockchain is open source software. The code is published and anyone can inspect or use it. But the key control of the Liquid network, the ability to create blocks, and the securing of LBTC to BTC is restricted to a limited number of companies. It used to be 15. I'm not sure of the exact number now. So there are risks. If you use Liquid, the biggest risks are delay or refusal of peg out. While the use cases might be similar, in implementation, Liquid is nothing at all like the Lightning Network. The Lightning Network is built on the main Bitcoin blockchain, and people running Lightning nodes hold the keys to their own Bitcoin. All of the off-chain transactions are secured not by a federation of companies guaranteeing a peg, but by the Lightning node operators having pre-signed unpublished transactions with their channel partners. These transactions can be published at any time to the Bitcoin blockchain. So if you run a Lightning node, you can gain the advantage of faster, cheaper transactions while still retaining all the control of having your keys to your Bitcoin. But running a Lightning node requires some technical knowledge to operate the node and manage the channels that allow you to transact over the Lightning network. This has its own risks. In summary, Liquid Bitcoin is not the same as regular Bitcoin, but it can still be very useful. I've used Liquid Bitcoin on occasion, just as I use Strike and other custodial solutions for specific purposes. you should feel free to start using Liquid and other custodial solutions as you're getting started and with smaller amounts of Bitcoin. But your goal should always be to understand and use Bitcoin on-chain for your main long-term holdings. If you're willing to invest the time, money, and effort into learning about Lightning and running your own node, you can get the best of both worlds: faster, cheaper transactions while keeping your keys to your Bitcoin. This has been Jesse Markowitz with your personal BitcoinAssistant.com. Please keep sending these questions in to Jack. Answering these is the favorite part of my week.
I'm going to say something here that if you take it wrong, you could take it as I'm talking down to somebody, and I'm not. And I don't claim to be an expert at liquid Bitcoin. But what I'm going to say is, if you don't know the answer to what liquid Bitcoin is, you probably don't have a use case for it, okay? If you had a use case for it, you probably would seek it out and find it, because it's kind of specific in what it does. And it does have some advantages over Lightning, as in it doesn't have any channels, it doesn't have any routing risk, it doesn't have any inbound liquidity management, and so you don't get failed payments because liquidity isn't on the right side of the channel because they're in the channel in the first place. It is designed to run easily, less contention. And it is custodial in a way, but it's also more private than Lightning, because not only do you not really know who the other party is unless you're dealing with them directly, the amounts of the transactions are hidden by default, so there's a level of privacy between counterparties. What is like the application that this was built for, though? I would say the application, but like one of the main use case applications for it would be something like, we have a group of 10 companies, and these 10 companies are constantly doing business with each other and doing intercompany billing. So maybe, you know, company A is a supplier to company B, but company B is a provider to company C, and company C is actually a buyer also from company A, and company D is a supplier to company A. You get what I'm saying? Now, there's more of this out there than you think there is, because you have common suppliers, common providers, all types, and when you get into the world of cryptocurrency exchanges, you also have exchange transactions, including atomic swaps, making tokens based on other things other than Bitcoin, all that other shit, right? So in that scenario, you basically have a private banking system for those companies to operate within, and they have all the data on their side to open and close out their books for each payment cycle and what have you. But they don't really see what everybody else is doing in the confederacy that you kind of have, federation that you have there. That's kind of the application for it. There is it is not something that if you run a website you want to use to take payments. It doesn't really make a lot of sense for something like that. A general payments network is what Lightning is designed to be, and Liquid is more of a company, not only, but like the primary reason is a company-to-company type scenario with ongoing regular transactions in multiple directions through multiple people within this federation, okay? That's the best I can do. Jesse's is probably better. My thing is, it's not something, unless you're just a straight-up Bitcoin student, that you need to really worry about. So now we're going to hear about cloning a plant that I'm not even going to try to pronounce again because I get it wrong. I've never even seen this plant. I should look it up while Nick's talking about it. But this is a guy that wants to make clones, rooted cuttings in this case, and he's done it plenty of times, but he wants to know, like, how big of a cutting can I make? And Nick's got some good advice for him.
Hey there, Nick Ferguson here with another Expert Council answer. I am glad to be back. I missed answering your questions while on those massive tours of the USA this whole summer. Quick update, family events slowed me down over the holidays. Everyone is good now, and hopefully there's no more emergencies this year. But the Rare Plant Store New Year sale should launch this weekend or early next week. It just all depends on how things go and if Murphy throws any wrenches my way again. Stay tuned for reservation orders. If you go to the website, I have a Telegram group where you can get a notification as soon as the tree packs are available for pre-order. But now we're on to Mick's question, and he writes, "Hey Jack, question for Nick Ferguson. I'm trying to figure out how big of a green giant arborvitae cutting I can get to root. I've had a lot of success propagating green giant arborvitae from small cuttings over the years, but currently have a few gaps in my green wall around my property. I have a few that are bigger than I need." I'm guessing gaps? Oh, the trees are bigger than he needs. "And I'm wondering if I can top them and use them to fill in the gaps. Basically, how big of a cutting can I use and get it to root? Can I cut something that has a 3-inch trunk?" Nope. "And stick it in a bucket of water with rooting hormone and have a plantable tree in a couple months. If not, any way I can do this other than small cuttings and a bit more patience. Thanks." The short answer, no. You're not going to get a 3-inch trunk cutting to root in a bucket of water in a couple months. Honestly, it's probably just most likely going to rot. So I personally would just stick with 4 to 8-inch cuttings for your best results. For bigger pieces, if you're just dead set on getting a bigger chunk in the ground sooner, air layering is probably your best bet. You should expect a rooted section in 3 to 6 months, but honestly, it's probably best to just harvest that layered cutting in the winter when growth is slowest. Honestly, I'd stick with what you know works. Take those smaller cuttings, root them normally, and just be patient. A lot of that growth potential is going to be slowed down by how they are treated once they're in the ground. If there's a good mulch layer, if they're getting fertilized well, and if they're getting watered sufficiently, you can overtake a tremendous amount of time by just making sure all of those parameters are met very well. So, on to why those big cuttings fail. The small young shoots have what are essentially stem cells ready to form roots, but those cuttings lose water fast through the leaves. Transpiration is kind of like sweating. So a small cutting under a humidity dome has low water loss, and has a high amount of those stem cells because it's younger wood. So it survives long enough to root because it can root quickly because all those stem cells are ready to just rock and roll and turn into roots. Those bigger topped branches that are sometimes 3, 4, 5 years old, that wood is going to have lots of leaves, no roots, and the cambium is going to have relatively few of those stem cells present in the area that's going to be exposed to the pressure that's going to tell it to make roots. So basically what's going to happen is it's going to be dehydrating fast. And because there's not a whole lot of those stem cells, it's not going to form the roots quick enough, and it's just going to either rot or dehydrate to death. So it's all about balancing water loss, rooting potential, and time. So what we want to do is find the pieces of the plant that have the most rooting potential and push those portions to root and get them in an environment that's going to support that. So best options for your green wall gaps. Take small cuttings, just use your proven method. Take 4 to 8-inch pieces, tips. Use rooting hormone. That's going to be 3,000 to 8,000 ppm IBA talc, if I remember correctly. And put them in moist perlite sand under a dome, or what's even better is under mist with bottom heat. They should root in 1 to 3 months and grow quickly once you get them planted. You can air layer the larger pieces. So spring, early summer, pick a healthy branch. Girdle it by removing a 1 to 2-inch ring of both the inner and outer bark. And you leave that cutting attached to the tree. You're just removing the bark in a strip. And then you apply rooting hormone to the top part of the cut where you can see the cambium from the part that's going to be the new cutting. And you pack around that with damp sphagnum moss or peat moss potting mix and wrap it in plastic. It should look like a big grapefruit or softball of potting mix wrapped in plastic. And you really want to wrap paper on the outside of that so you don't turn that plastic and potting mix into like this greenhouse baking thing. That's just going to cook those roots to death in the sun. Roots should form in 3 to 6 months. Cut and plant it in winter, preferably. And honestly, what I would do, start those extra small cuttings now in a nursery bed. Keep a rotation of those cuttings going into pots, jumping up in a pot size every year. That way, in a few years, you'll have relatively large replacements if you ever need one. You can just swap out the failing or dead one with a big one that you've gotten in one of those big 20-gallon tree pots. Great question, Mick. For everyone else in the TSP audience, please send your homesteading, propagation, permaculture, or homeschooling questions, and watch for the 2026 RarePlantStore.com pre-orders dropping soon. I have some really cool stuff hitting the store this year. I'm Nick Ferguson from Homegrown Liberty and RarePlantStore.com. Do good things.
So it's arborvitae, and I did look it up while you were talking. It's one of those smack your head on the stuff on the forehead like a V8 commercial from the 90s and go, duh. These are the quintessential landscaping evergreen, tall, thin, where the balms, unless you prune them off, go all the way to the ground. They also, something my wife loves these things and anything like them, and unfortunately they just do not do well here. We are too far south, too hot, and too alkaline for these trees. But that's what they are. So, okay, good advice from Nick. Now, let's talk about something totally different. I want to talk to you about this new food pyramid that just dropped. And it's really interesting to me. And is it perfect? No. No. And I actually think that if you fully dig into it, it probably allows more sugar than it should. If you were to use the maximum amount of sugar in every place that it's applicable, it definitely would. However, if I were to say, if I took the food pyramid we all grew up with and then the Biden administration spent $9 million to turn it from a pyramid to a plate, even though none of the recommendations were changed, and said that on a scale of 1 to 100, with 100 being absolute perfection, and 0 being, it says eat cyanide and kill yourself, where would the original food pyramid have ranked? And I would say about a 20 on that scale. And there's a lot of people would take me to task with that because it's too low, and a lot of people would take me to task for being too high. I think if you followed the existing food pyramid, you would live a reasonably okay life, and you'd stay alive, and you wouldn't die. So I'll give it at least a 20. I also think that it was completely overweighted to the side of big food, who likes to sell things in boxes, and so saying grains included all the powder-mixed shit. And hence, it resulted in even a lot of people thought they were following it and really weren't, because you don't do the kind of analysis we're going to do today on the new one. And so I would say 20-25, and if you wanted me to, like, if you strong-armed me to push it up to a 30, okay. If you followed it to the letter and you also ate high-quality food, with, I'd give it a 30 out of 100. It's still a cattle feed bag. It's still a pig feed bag. All right? That's what it was. And it was not the food humans are supposed to live on. If I take RFK's new version, which really isn't RFK, he kind of pushed it, but it ain't like he sat down and personally did it, I would rate it somewhere around 75 to an 80, and that's for government a home run. I mean, government never gets anything 100% right. And, you know, there is a place in all this where we start to move into two things. The realm of opinion, including Jack Spirko's opinion. And then there's another thing, the world of compliance. If you give people something so outrageously against what they want to do anyway, they'll just not do any of it. And instead of getting partial compliance, you'll get no compliance, and you won't make a difference. I also think that the world, it doesn't really understand how big a deal this is yet, because what they're saying right now to counteract it is all the dietitians and all the doctors and all the blah, blah, blah all say that you're supposed to. But where did they get that from? Where did all of that? It came from 70 years of the clown pyramid. Okay? or 50 years, really, because 1971, yeah, that's about when all this shit started everywhere, okay? So more than 50 years of the clown pyramid is what has it in all the medical schools. It's why you and I remember being taught this nonsense and coloring pyramids in with crayons when we were, you know, barely out of the stage of shit in our pants. And we were picking our nose and eating our boogers, and we were being trained in this bullshit. Where did that come from? It came from government. So when it changes at that level, it will slowly push through and change many other things. And you say, well, no, they'll just do whatever they want. Big food, blah, blah, blah. Well, I'm going to explain something to you. A lot of this shit is paid for by government. And it turns out that when government pays for shit, it comes with these things called mandates. And if you want our money for your nutritional program that we're giving you to teach people, whether it's in school or at a corporate level or whatever, if you want the money, then you're going to follow our recommendations. That's why this matters. But let's talk about what it is. It says things, and then when you read further in, it doesn't necessarily say them the way you think. So a basic recommendation overall is like your food should be based on things like whole milk, high-quality fats from animals, and don't fear fat. However, when you read into the dairy recommendations, it includes no fat, low fat, and high fat all the same. But it still has these other recommendations that are pretty solid. So it does give serving recommendations, but when you go look at the pyramid that they released, it doesn't really. And when you go look at the page that the government has set up for it, which is realfood.gov, it's there, but it's the realfood.gov site is terrible. It's too busy. Whoever made it tried to be too fancy with it. I'm sure even with Trump and the whole idea of cutting expenses, somebody got this who was all clever beyond, like, clever to the point of being stupid and jumbled. And there's three links today. One is to realfood.gov, so you can see what I'm talking about. You see the pyramid, and you can get the data if you dig hard enough, but it's not just there and simple, and it's a busy page, and even with high-speed internet, it's so fucking busy, it's like waiting for all the ads to load on the Weather Channel. It's a pain in the ass. But then they have two downloads you can get in PDF. One's daily serving recommendations and portion sizes, and the other is dietary guidelines for Americans. And to really get the data I'm about to give you, it was necessary, because I don't hate my life, to download those documents and use those to get this. So here's the basic recommendations. Protein, that you should get between 0.54 to 0.73 grams per pound of body weight per day. Now, obviously, this is not necessarily what you need to be doing if you weigh 400 pounds. And that's a big part of the big variability there as well. These are recommendations considering you are of reasonable size and health right now, so you may have to adapt them if you're trying to lose weight, gain weight, etc. But that overall recommendation I am fine with as a general recommendation. If you are trying to actually put on muscle and all, you might need to be more in the realm of like 1 gram per pound. But there's nothing wrong with that. You're not going to become protein deficient in that range. And you are going to be well satiated if you're adding fats. And if you're getting your protein from the sources that are recommended, which is like high-quality animal protein and things like that, that amount of protein is going to get you the amount of fat you need. Now, yeah, you could be eating, you know, Eye of Round or Filet Mignon. They are very, very lean cuts on any given day, and maybe your fat's going to be a little low. But on other days, you're eating your ribeye or your pork chop or whatever, your fat is going to go back up. So I think that works. Vegetables and fruits, they say 3 servings a day of vegetables and 2 servings a day of fruits. To really understand that recommendation, you need to be clear about what a fruit is and is not. This is something we talk about gardening at times. A tomato is a fruit. A cucumber is a fruit. A pepper is a fruit. An eggplant is a fruit. A fruit is not only something like an apple or a berry. Okay, those are fruits. A vegetable would be a leafy green, which there's a little bit of a difference in the portion size there, but a carrot would be a vegetable. A potato would be a vegetable. Celery would be a vegetable. Okay? These are things that are not leafy greens. They're a little more substantial, but they're true vegetables. If it has a seed inside the part you eat, it is a fruit, and you'll notice that. Does that need to be rigorously? I think there's a lot of room for flexibility in this pyramid, which I like, because a pepper acts a lot more like a vegetable than a fruit, where a tomato acts a little more like a fruit from a macronutrient standpoint, i.e., there's a lot more sugar in a whole, you know, beefsteak tomato than there is in a pepper, okay? Just kind of saying there, even though they're both nightshades. But the basic recommendation is that you're supposed to be eating 3 servings a day of vegetables and 2 servings a day of fruits. I'm fine with that. It's not what I would personally do, especially if you need to reduce your weight and you're a carbohydrate addict, but it's not a bad recommendation. Now, what is a serving? Because that's kind of important. For vegetables, a cup is 1 cup for most vegetables, is what it would be, raw or cooked. That sounds like pretty generous when you get 3 servings a day, but a cup isn't as much as you think it is. If you start measuring your food, it's not very much. And leafy greens, 2 cups is a serving. So if you had a side salad, mixed baby spinach and arugula or something like that, 2 cups of that would be 1 serving of vegetables, and then, you know, whatever else you ate that day would be your other servings. Fruit, they say 1 cup raw, or 1/2 cup dried. And that means you could have more than one kind. When you put these things together, you would want to take a look at the amounts. And these are rough estimates. I don't see anybody measuring every single thing they eat unless they're on a really controlled diet for a purpose, okay? Whole grains, traditionally prepared. What that means is like bread should be sourdough. Okay, this food pyramid basically says, you know all that fancy white bread garbage shit on all the shelves? Don't fucking eat any of that. Okay, that's what it says. Now, when you go into the FAQ, it also says this is not like a rigid required diet. This is a suggestion for your base diet, your core diet. Okay, but whole grains traditionally prepared allows up to 2 to 4 servings a day. What is a serving, though? 1 tortilla or slice of bread or 1 cup of cooked traditional grain. And it steers you toward things like rice, oats, quinoa, which is really a seed, stuff like that, though. And if you're going to eat wheat, then you're looking at, you know, wheats that are like einkorn, spelt, and things like that, ancient wheats, not these modern wheats, though. I guarantee you grain is going to be considered grain, and it's a whole grain. But if you were following it as best you could, then if you wanted 2 slices of bread today, okay, that's 2 to 4 servings. That's 2 of your servings. But those 2 slices should come from real sourdough using a traditional wheat that was fully fermented, not made to quick rise with these quick rise instant yeasts that we use and have used for about 200 years. That's what it says. You can agree or disagree. But that's what it says. No added sugars, no seed oils, no additives, no food dyes are on this as a recommended food. It doesn't mean you can't have any. It means it's not recommended. And then added sugar limits. If you do it anyway, if you do add some sugar, what they say is you can add about 5 grams of sugar per serving of grain. I think this is making an allowance for a freaking cupcake. Like, maybe it doesn't mean you do it every. Now, that's where you could get in trouble. If I put this, I'm gonna probably put this thing into a spreadsheet and see if you did exactly what it said you're allowed to do, what it would look like by the end of the day. I think just because you can do a thing doesn't mean you have to. This is a maximum amount thing. But what is 5 grams? Because most people don't think in grams. It's about 1.2 teaspoons, not tablespoons, teaspoons. Now, that means that if you had a full 4 servings of grains a day, and you did it for every one of them, was that 4.8 teaspoons. That's a lot of sugar just in your grains. plus the natural sugars that are already like in fruits and vegetables and things like that. So do with that. Dairy, 2.5 grams per serving. And that's like a cup of dairy, is because I didn't put that in my list, but that's what I remember being about a dairy is about a cup of whether it's yogurt or milk or whatever. So about 2.5 grams, which is about 0.6 teaspoons, half a teaspoon roughly. That's not that much, you know, unless you eat like 4 cups of yogurt a day or something like that. Anything else, though, that is in the list, because I'm not going to name all the things in the list, no more than 1 gram, which is a quarter teaspoon. But that could be like to make a sauce for your pork chop. So if you did this on every single serving within the guidelines and stuck to it 100%, this could add up to quite a bit of sugar. But I don't think it's meant to be used that way. These are like when you need to, this is how much per serving at maximum. Okay. The resources for the new guideline, again, you can find it at realfood.gov. And then the two guides that I recommend that are there, the daily serving recommendations and portion sizes, that's one guide, and the dietary guidelines for Americans, that's another. There's a bunch of other shit there, but most of it is like the full study, the source data, and most of y'all are going to be interested in that. Let me say a couple things about this and how I think this could actually be a fantastic way for most people to eat. Jack, you're keto, borderline carnivore. Yeah, I try to stay that way. However, if you've listened, you know that I've always said things, even when I have Ken Berry himself on show with me, there's still something more to this, because if I go back to 1970s, before a complete takeover by Big Sugar and everything, the Americans ate an awful lot of potatoes and bread. We did, and we did not have the obesity problems of today. And no, it isn't because everybody was working out all the time, because I lived then, and no, they were not. Stop saying stupid, especially you young fuckers that are like 25, 30 years old. Like you people, well, your birthday starts with a two, your birth year starts with a 2-0. We're not really interested in your opinion about what happened in 1980. You weren't here. So I'm going to tell you that people were not that much more physically active. More, yes. That much more to make up the difference in what we're seeing today? No, they were not. We didn't sit around with our phones all day long on our ass looking at our phones and playing video games on our phones and doing social media on it because it didn't exist. But we all spent an awful lot of time with a thing called a fucking Atari, okay? And a computer called a fucking Commodore. And kids sitting around on their ass is not new, nor is adults sitting around on their ass. So there is something to the way the food, not only recommendations, but the food itself was changed as to the obesity problem and the diabetes and everything that goes with it. It is not all just too much carbs. I've always said that. I think that the average person today, when they track their carbs, I've heard this more times than I can count. I've had people say, you know what, Jack, I want to give it a chance. I want to do things. And they say, what do I do first? And I'm like, get this app. Keto.app. Don't change anything for the first week. Just track everything you eat and tell me what you get out of it. One more week won't hurt you. Tell me what you're getting. The average person is eating somewhere between 250 and 450 carbohydrates a day without even thinking about it. And the reason I have a lot of people do that before they start, I can tell they're not completely sold on the idea yet, and they need to understand how bad it really is. My sister-in-law did this, and she was eating an average of 400 carbohydrates a day. If you added one check to this U.S. government food pyramid, and this is not doing net carbs where we take the fiber out, and you said, I will follow this full food pyramid for 95% of my dietary choices, and on top of that, I will do a basic daily sanity check on carbs, and if I eat 40 carbs one day, no big deal, then it's lower than what I'm about to say, and I'm not going to always go to the maximum. But if you said, I will never eat more than 100 carbohydrates in a day and followed this, you'd probably live pretty damn healthy. If you would bring that number down to 75, which would allow you a tremendous amount of variety, you stuck to real nutritious whole grains, brown rice, things like that when you're doing this. You didn't eat anything that came out of a box unless they put the vegetables in a box for you or something. Like, you know what I'm talking about. You stay the fuck out of the center of the grocery store, and you followed this, I think the health of America would be so dramatically improved that it would be difficult to explain to people who grew up 30 years from now that it wasn't always this way and that we actually thought it was a good idea to do what we did for the last 50 years. They wouldn't even understand you. It wouldn't even make any sense. And here's the thing that I'm going to say about this food pyramid that is not true of keto, carnivore. I don't want to say paleo because it ain't that, if you actually do it, it ain't that far off paleo. Or primal type diets. But in many of these diets that are carbohydrate restrictive diets, you're going to find that it's a lot more compliance friendly. Because you cannot expect government to put something out like this if they're trying anyway. Okay? That, you know, 90% of people just will not do. Like, even if they get to, like, I'm going to do the recommendations, right? That's in your head. But then when you read them, I think if you went to the level that I might say would be optimum for, and there's a different other side too. Is this for weight loss or is this the way you're supposed to eat every day? Because this is a dietary guideline, not a diet. And I think if you tell the average person, they say, well, can I have bread? Well, you know, on any given day, you can have up to 4 slices of bread. But really, you should anchor down to more like 2 slices of bread or other grains for that day, most days. And then on days where you splurge a little bit, you can go up to 4. They would say, huh, well, I can make a sandwich with 2 pieces of bread. That covers my lunch. So I can work with that. You know, you can have 2 tortillas a day. So that means I can have tacos. Yeah, you just need to use good, high quality, maybe make your own tortillas or buy something that's made out of, you know, an organic whole grain or something like that. I can do that. And even if you're going to eat a white flour tortilla, right? Well, you need to buy organic and, you know, high quality and something that's made without soybean oil. You see what I'm saying? I can do that. And I think it's way more important that you give something good that's largely doable than do something great that most people, even though they could do it, are not going to. Anybody that wants to can eat this way. And the variety even in keto is tremendous. But the variety that's available here is extensive. And I would give this about an 80. 75-80 is a score on 1 to 100 is being optimized. But for government to do this, if I'm giving it a letter grade, it is an A fucking plus. This is one of the best things, it might be the best thing, I've ever seen come out of government in my life, judging it as a government program or recommendation. You know, do you know what's not on here? Soda, Coke, etc. There's not even anything on here about sugary sweets and stuff like that. I think that's actually a good thing because if you tell people, well, you can have 2 things a day, two sugary sweetie things a day, 1 Coke and 1 cupcake, they're going to do it every day. And if you say use it with moderation, that's very subjective. I think that the entire mindset needs to be, cake, cookies, candies, all that shit is poison. Treat it like alcohol. Yeah, you can have it once in a while, but that's not all the time. You know, well, what about birthday cake when there's a birthday? Well, do you work in an office with 80 people and there's a birthday cake being cut up twice a fucking week? And that's your excuse? You have to because it's a birthday? Bullshit. Right? If you work in an office with 10 people in it and there's cake in the freaking office 3 times a year because they put everybody's birthday from the same month or same 2 months together for one, you know, little celebration. Nah, go ahead. Fuck it. I've always said that even when I'm keto. That's just a day you failed, but it's okay to fail with intent on occasion. This is amazing. Let me also say, one of the reasons I think I'm so impressed by it is because I do not expect it. right? One of the main reasons is to be like, I'm disappointed in Trump. I'm disappointed in J.D. Vance. I'm not disappointed because I don't expect much out of government. So maybe I'm a little bit impressed because I don't expect anything good. But this is an A+. It's an A+. And I I'm going to say that I think that the key to this is to focus on what you need to eat a day. Get the protein requirements down and increase them if you need to for your fitness goals. I mean, if you're a dude that's already jacked and you're pounding iron, you know, 4 days a week, and you have goals to put more muscle mass on, you do need to get more into that 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight, okay? But if you're in the realm of like 0.7 grams, a lot of real protein, okay? Real protein, not protein powder, Ma, right? Not soy curds, real protein from things with a face, and from things like eggs, okay? If you're in that realm, all the rest of this is going to shape itself out rather nicely because you're not going to feel compelled to eat all the other garbage. It's solid. So for government, it's an A+. Anyway, with that, we've wrapped things up. And by the way, I think the only credit Donald Trump gets for this is appointing RFK. That's it. I don't think he had a damn thing to do with this as far as it being put together. And it's well done. And if it took a year to get this done after 50 years of garbage, I'm impressed. Anyway, guys, take care. I'll be back with you on Monday. We'll have a brand new show. I haven't decided what we're going to do yet. I think that maybe Monday is going to be one of these shows where we kind of go around the pike and we look at what's going on. We got a lot to talk about. There may be some new developments with the Venezuela thing. I know a lot of y'all thought maybe today you'd hear about the girl that got shot by the ICE officer. I don't know enough yet, but it damn sure looks to me like she tried to run the guy over and he shot her. And that's what happens when you try to run a law enforcement officer over, you get shot. I take no joy in that, but I also say that's what happens when you try to run somebody over who's telling you not to leave, and they're a law enforcement officer, you get shot. I won't say any more than that today. I'm sure it'll piss somebody off. They'll have to send me one of these emails that I just delete and don't even read or what have you. But there's a lot going on, and there'll probably be a lot of stuff dropping over the weekend, and probably you're probably going to hear some more rumbling about the whole Greenland thing. That's going to be interesting to see play out. So maybe we'll take more of a current events type approach on Monday, but I haven't decided yet. Tune in and you'll find out. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Revolution.